Good evening. My name is Karen Seidman. I am the special needs coordinator for the Cuyahoga County Board of Health. I work here as a contractor, and welcome tonight. We're going to talk about respiratory illnesses and disease. The goal of these presentations is to plan and operate emergency shelters and points of dispensing in Northeast Ohio, responsive to the needs of all community members. For today, the objectives of our program today are to, number one, understand normal respiratory function, and number two, is to develop strategies to manage people with respiratory disease during disaster, especially a disaster requiring the evacuation and sheltering of those people. Our presenter today is Rachel Vanek. I hope, Rachel, you yes. will introduce yourself a little bit more. She is an acute care nurse practitioner, and she is with Medical Intensive Care Unit at University Hospitals Case Medical Center. So I will turn it over to Rachel, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
It's great to see everybody out tonight. Welcome. A couple of familiar faces, and got to know a few of you while we're waiting. I grew up here in Geauga County, went to Virginia for school and fell in love and all that good stuff, but ended up back in Geauga County in 1991, which was one of the worst winters in recent remembrances. So what we're going to do tonight is talk a little bit about the evacuation and management and important principles for people with respiratory illnesses, respiratory failure. It's sort of brief. I don't think it's going to take till 8 o'clock. But what I'd really like to do is answer your questions. What kind of questions, what kind of problems have you seen? What kind of situations have you been in where you were faced with a problem for somebody who had respiratory symptoms and you weren't sure what to do and you just want to talk about that? So in the early 1980s, the Dismal Swamp in Tidewater, Virginia caught on fire. And it's a bog. It's a gigantic bog, and all the peat moss was on fire, and it smoked and smoked and smoked. We lived in Virginia Beach, which was about 63 miles away, and if the wind blew the right direction, Virginia Beach was inundated with people with asthma exacerbations, COPD exacerbations, and I worked in the emergency room at Portsmouth Naval Hospital and at Portsmouth Medical Center at that point in time, and whenever that wind blew from the west, we got patients with symptoms of smoke inhalation. So that's one sort of thing that you're going to see. Next slide. Apartment fires. Do you guys remember the big apartment fire downtown Cleveland last year? Had to evacuate a lot of elderly, disabled, poor people who were evacuated to shelters, many of them with lots of medical illnesses, respiratory illnesses, some smoke inhalation, but mostly it was exposure to cold air. People who got separated from their medical devices, they didn't have an oxygen tank or they couldn't get their tank out quick enough or they didn't have their nebulizer or any other kind of supplies that they usually use to take care of their own symptoms. They were evacuated in a variety of directions. Some went to hospitals, some went to other nursing homes and facilities for placement. They put some in hotels, and all these people really needed help with managing their illness. Some people had some assistance, but some people really didn't. I know that a lot of community resources were mobilized to care for these folks. Next slide. Heat waves. I love this picture. I thought that was really cute. July around here was really hot. When it's hot out, if you don't have air conditioning or you don't have a way to keep the temperature even, big fluctuations in temperature can result in an exacerbation. When I say exacerbation, I mean a worsening of symptoms of your respiratory disease. Cold snaps. When the weather gets really cold, frigid air causes a dryness. When you get a depletion of water or too much water in the air, that can cause respiratory symptoms as well. Water. Exposure to a lot of water, flooding, which predisposes formation of mold and the spread of bacteria in the air, can all cause worsening of symptoms such as asthma, emphysema. Transmission of disease, communicable diseases, is enhanced in flood situations. Weather. Whenever severe weather hits, we often will get a very large fluctuation in people who are coming to the hospital with symptoms of respiratory failure, shortness of breath, cough, mostly because what happens is debris is picked up by the weather, whether it be a wind, tornado, hurricane-type situation. We don't see that in Ohio, but all this causes dispersal of small particles in the air. And when those get into your airway, if you have, if, for example, people who smoke cigarettes don't have the cilia that help excrete these the small particulate matter that gets in the airway, and they tend to cough more. So you'll see patients get, or people get, I'll start using the word patients because I'm used to that. People will get an exacerbation of their acute illnesses. Next slide, illness outbreaks. Flu season. Everybody here gets their flu shot every year? No. flu outbreaks can result. People who are prone to respiratory diseases or have emphysema, they have asthma, they have cystic fibrosis, if they catch the flu, it can make their underlying chronic respiratory illness much worse. Cold season, waterborne illness, and then living in crowded situations. If they've been evacuated from home and now they're living in a gymnasium, there's a lot of people around, people tend to pick up cold, flu, and other viruses spread very rapidly in that type of situation. Who here knows what the best way to prevent the spread of infection is? Washing hands. Good, good. Very good. Next slide. So dust and environmental disasters. This can, things like the Santa Ana winds out west, toxic chemical leaks is something that we don't think a lot of, but a couple years ago there was a train that derailed in, I think it was New Jersey, that had ammonium chloride, you fire people, what is it, what's the ammonium gas that was released, caused a lot of respiratory illness. Not in just people who have underlying chronic disease, but people who are healthy. Was causing respiratory illness. That's the type of exposure that require broad evacuation, not just of people who are ill, but people who are well in that area. Next slide. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about normal respiratory functions and then determine strategies to manage patients who have underlying chronic respiratory diseases when they've been evacuated to a shelter situation. Anatomy and physiology. So the respiratory system is comprised of the upper airway, then conducting system, which is the large airways, and then the gas exchange units, which are the smaller units inside the lung where the gas exchange occurs. The upper airway filters and warms the air. So when we are outside, it filters particulate matter, it filters particulate matter gases in the upper airway. They're warmed before they reach the lungs, and then the lower part of the lungs is what actually causes where the gas exchange occurs. So this is just a diagram. Goes over a little bit of the respiratory system. You can see it. The respiratory system includes the oropharynx, the pharynx, which is in the back of the throat, the epiglottis, which is what separates the esophagus from the trachea, and then the lungs come down, and there's actually two lobes in the left, three lobes in the right, and the airways branch off into smaller and smaller segments till they reach the gas exchange units, which are out in the periphery of the lung. So the lung is one of the smart organs. It has two circulatory systems. It has blood that comes deoxygenated, meaning there's no oxygen in it, from the heart, goes to the lungs and it's oxygenated, but it also has its own oxygen supply because it's tissue that needs to get oxygen from the heart. So off of the aorta come the bronchial arteries, and those are the arteries that feed the lung and keep the lung tissue healthy. There's no test on this part. I see panic in the back of the room. So. The diaphragm, the intercostal muscles, are all muscles of respiration. When we're awake, we can use accessory muscles. If you've ever seen somebody breathing really hard, they'll use their neck muscles, shoulder muscles, trapezius. When we fall asleep, it's our intercostal muscles and our diaphragm that does the work of breathing for us. And this becomes more, a little bit more clinically important when we talk a little bit more about patients who have diseases. The little picture up in the left-hand corner is just the alveolar unit. And the anybody heard of the alveoli? So alveoli are where the gas exchange actually occurs. Oxygen is absorbed, carbon dioxide is excreted, and then ventilated out of the lung. Next slide. Okay, so what are some functions of the respiratory system? So the respiratory system has a lot of functions. It warms and humidifies air. It provides oxygen for gas and removes carbon dioxide, which is your gas exchange. It has a cough and a sneeze reflex, which helps you expel any particulate matter that can be inhaled. The other thing the lung does is it does filter small particles in the circulation and absorb them into cells in the lung, which helps absorb them and get them into the lymphatic system to be excreted. It also releases and converts hormones. People don't usually think of the lungs as hormones, but they convert angiotensin-converting enzyme, which helps regulate blood pressure and vascular tone. Moving on to respiratory disorders, let's see, who here knows the number one cause of emphysema?
Smoking.
Great, very good. Anybody in here smoke? Put them on the spot. I used to smoke, so I'm a reformed smoker. So there's a lot of respiratory disorders. I listed some here just to kind of go through. We'll talk, these are some of the big ones. We'll talk a little bit about each one and a little bit about what you'll see out in the community. So COPD is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It's synonymous with emphysema. It's what happens in COPD. I'm just going to give you a little brief blurb about each one. What happens in COPD is the lung tissue loses its elasticity and it traps air. So people become hyperinflated and they can't excrete the carbon dioxide as well. They also have a lot more secretions that tend to pool in the lungs because the cilia don't function properly, and they get a lot of secretions and sputum. So asthma, anybody in here have asthma?
Okay, good.
A lot of people who have asthma have reactive upper airways, so the big airways that transmit gas to the periphery of your lungs become reactive. And they tend to swell either with edema and inflammation and close down, which makes air hard to get in and harder to get out. So they tend to trap air within their lungs. Heart failure. Heart failure causes respiratory symptoms because the left side of the heart is what drains blood from the lungs. When the left side of the heart starts to fail, from a variety of things, people can have heart attacks, and their left side of their heart doesn't pump blood efficiently, the blood will pool in the lungs, and then the water from the blood diffuses into the alveoli, and people get congested. Have you ever heard of congestive heart failure? And that's what it's called, is congestive heart failure from the water backing up in the lungs. And those people really get a lot of, when their heart failure gets bad, they get very short of breath, they get a lot of secretions, a lot of clear, frothy secretions. Pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension is we're seeing more and more pulmonary hypertension. There's basically five classes of pulmonary hypertension. Those won't be on the test. But basically what pulmonary hypertension is that the pulmonary arteries that leave the heart and feed the deoxygenated blood to the lungs become very hypertrophied, or I'm sorry, if I flip into lingo, just hit me. They become very thickened and stiff, and so the blood pressure in the lungs goes up. The normal blood pressure in those arteries, like the blood pressure in my artery is 120 over 70, except now it's about 180. the blood pressure in the pulmonary artery is only about 25 over 15. But we've seen people come in whose blood pressure is 100 over 50 in their lungs, and that's very high. And what happens is the right side of the heart has to pump that blood out to the lungs, but it can't because those arteries are too stiff and they resist blood flow. So the right side of the heart gets really big and has to work really hard, and those patients go into heart failure. It can be treated, but it's difficult to treat, and oftentimes patients with severe pulmonary hypertension have to get a lung transplant. But those patients are now living longer because there's more therapies that are available to help them and to give them more life. So we're seeing those patients out in the community with these therapies, which I'm going to show you some pictures of, walking around, getting stronger, in order to prepare themselves for a lung transplant. Pneumonia. Pneumonia is a clinical diagnosis. Pneumonia occurs when a bacteria or virus gets into the lung, and your basic immune system and defense mechanisms can't fight it, and it starts to take over, and it basically blossoms in your lung. And it causes inflammation in your lung. And I often tell patients, you have to think of it like you sprain your ankle and your ankle swells. You've sprained your lung. You have pneumonia in there. It's swollen. It's edematous. There's pus. White blood cells are in there trying to fight this infection off. And that's why you have these symptoms. They get pain. They get fever. They get short of breath. And they cough. They get a lot of sputum production. And the sputum usually has some consistency to it, some color to it, and all those are signs of pneumonia. In the very young, the very old, or in people who have underlying conditions, has about a 15 to 20% mortality, even with good antibiotics. So if people get signs and symptoms of pneumonia, prompt treatment, prompt antibiotic therapy is warranted. Pulmonary embolism. Pulmonary embolism is a blood clot that's gone from the leg usually, as they usually find them in the leg, into the lung. And it comes up the inferior vena cava, which feeds the blood to the right side of the heart, and the blood clot comes up into the heart and then goes to the lung. Pulmonary embolism can be very fatal. Oftentimes patients present with shortness of breath, they have low oxygen levels on their blood gases, they have pain in their chest. Sometimes they'll cough up blood. Sometimes they have a fever. But one of the hallmarks is their chest x-ray is normal, but their oxygen levels are very low. It happens, so blood clots form in the legs when people are very sedentary or they have varicose veins in their legs or oftentimes you'll hear people flying for 8 hours and not moving, not getting up and walking around, and a blood clot forms in the legs and travels to the lungs. We treat pulmonary embolism with blood thinners, warfarin, Coumadin, put people on heparin and then Coumadin for usually at least 6 months after you've had a pulmonary embolism. Oh my gosh, I have pneumonia twice in here. Just checking. Sleep apnea is not really a respiratory disorder. That's a disorder of the upper airway. Anybody in here use CPAP? I'm really putting everybody on the... This is not HIPAA, is it? CPAP, my husband uses CPAP. He has obstructive sleep apnea. And sleep apnea is really a disorder of upper airway. What happens as we get older, we lose the collagen in the upper airway, and it becomes sloppy. And when we go to sleep and we stop using our accessory muscle, the airway closes on itself. And I know my husband goes and wakes himself up when he's doing his obstructive sleep apnea. The other thing with sleep apnea is very hard on the lungs and the heart. Those periods where your airway is obstructed and you're not breathing, it may be 5 seconds, it may be 10 seconds, it may be 15 seconds, your oxygen saturations are plummeting, your pulmonary artery pressure is going up, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, and you're not sleeping. It wakes you from REM sleep, so it has a lot of different effects and really should be treated. People who have sleep apnea have a CPAP machine, which means continuous positive airway pressure. It's a machine they strap on their nose at night when they go to sleep, and it helps stent the airway open. Lung cancer is on the rise, and it's on the rise in women. Lung cancer is becoming more of a chronic disease. It's becoming more treatable. But the key to lung cancer is early detection and early treatment. If lung cancer is identified early and treated early, sometimes it can just be resected, and that's it. Sometimes a combination of chemotherapy, radiation therapy can be employed to try to cure it. Fibrosis. Fibrosis is a process that occurs in the lung when can be anything. Asbestos used to, when people would work in asbestos without special protection, it would deposit in the lung and cause fibrosis. Inhalation of certain hot gases can cause fibrosis. But there's also an idiopathic form, which is another one of those medical words, which means we don't know why, but it forms in people's lungs as they get older. Sometimes it can be autoimmune type process, like rheumatoid arthritis, where the body actually forms an antibody to tissues or something that's in the lungs and causes fibrosis. What happens in fibrosis is the capillary membrane of the alveolus, which is where the gas exchange occurs, becomes very thick, and gas can't be transported across. So they get very short of breath, and they get very hypoxic, meaning low oxygen tension. There are some treatments, but there aren't a lot of treatments for pulmonary fibrosis, and oftentimes these folks are on oxygen around the clock. And another one I mentioned here is cystic fibrosis, which is a genetic disorder that results in the formation of cysts within the lung, secretions that are accumulate within the lung, and over time develops fibrotic changes in the lung that makes gas exchange difficult again. Kids with cystic fibrosis are living longer. We've seen them at we're a cystic fibrosis center in Rainbow Hospital. We've seen people with cystic fibrosis into their 50s and 60s. Cystic fibrosis tends to run on a continuum from mild disease to severe disease, and the lifespan can be depend upon the severity of the disease. Oftentimes, people with cystic fibrosis are transplant candidates, and once their breathing tests reach a certain level, they become candidates for a lung transplant. And there has been some success with cystic fibrosis. Do you guys have any other lung diseases that you can think of off the top of your head?
ALS.
So ALS is a disease, and that's amyotrophic lateralizing sclerosis. And what that, Lou Gehrig's disease, anybody heard of that? And that's a respiratory disease of the muscles and the nerves that feed the lungs and the muscles that help you breathe. People with ALS, it is a fatal disease. There's no cure, but they're giving people longer lives by giving them respiratory support. Oftentimes, we've been doing pacemakers, diaphragmatic pacemakers, in people with ALS as a way to stimulate the diaphragm to do the work of breathing that it won't do anymore because the nerves that feed the diaphragm don't work. Oftentimes, those patients are on ventilators. They'll have tracheostomies, or they'll have a non-invasive ventilator. Any other respiratory diseases you can think of? TB. TB. So Karen can talk a little bit about TB. TB, especially in crowded situations.
Tuberculosis is an infectious disease. It's caused by Mycobacterium tuberculosis. And about 80% of the people with active tuberculosis have it in their lungs. It can infect other parts of the body. It can infect, you can have TB meningitis. You can have all kinds of TB in places other than lungs, but we usually see it in the lungs, and it's treated with usually four drugs, antibiotics, and they're usually taken for at least 6 months. And those people possibly are infectious when they're started on medication, but after they've been on medication for a while, as long as it's not multiple drug-resistant TB, once they're on medication for usually a month or two, they become non-infectious. So if they are come into the shelter and tell you they're on TB medications, you need to start asking questions.
Okay? Good point.
What differentiates black lung disease
Plaque lung disease is a particulate disease. I don't know a lot about it, but what happens is they inhale the coal dust, which has a lot of particulate matter in it, and it deposits in the far out parts of the airways and causes an emphysematous-like picture, but I don't know much about how it's treated. I don't know. Do you know anything about how it's treated? I don't know how it's treated. Anybody exposed to coal dust or know anybody? Coal dust. We don't see that a lot around here. Do see it in the south, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, the coal belt region. In the last 50 years with the advent of OSHA, better ventilation in the mines, the use of particulate respiratory and masks, thank you, it has helped reduce the incidence of that, I'm told. But it is a exposure and an inhalation of particles. Okay, good. Guys are talking. Thank you. Anybody outside have any questions? Okay, next slide. So medical technologies. There's a lot of medical technologies, and the whole purpose of medical technologies is to help people live longer lives at an acceptable quality of life for them. Better lives, improving lives, people who have respiratory symptoms who are short of breath and disabled from that, if we can make them feel better and they can do more and get around more, then that improves their life. Oftentimes, people and patients are dependent on the technology to survive. Some of the things we're going to talk about are life-sustaining modalities. In other words, if that modality is taken away, they will die. It can be a simple thing, such as oxygen, or it can be something complex, such as mechanical ventilation in an ALS patient to keep them alive. And with the advent of computerized technology, we're seeing things get smaller and smaller. I have some pictures of some ventilators used to be, you know, iron lung was the first ventilator. Now the ventilators are this big and can go on the back of a wheelchair. Next slide. So the first thing I want to talk a little bit about is medications. When somebody comes to the shelter, and most people who are on any kind of medications know this, always have a list of your medications. You want to carry a list of your medications. People who are being evacuated, you would want to know what their allergies are. Most people, like my mother, has her medications every week. She sets them up in her pill boxes so she can take them if she needs to go. And having the name and number of the pharmacy is not essential, but it's convenient in case we don't know what medications they are, the patient can't tell us, or they don't have a list for any reason. So having the name and number of the pharmacy helps. We can call, and the pharmacy will be able to give you what medications the patient is on. There are some patients out there in the community who are on intravenous medications around the clock. They're infused either into the veins. Sometimes they're infused subcutaneously into the tissues. Things like insulin pumps can be used 24 hours a day subcutaneously into the tissues. And then Flolan, which is a medication that we use for pulmonary hypertension, actually infuses into the great vessels above the heart and requires special cassettes, special handling of the medication in order to infuse it into the central line. So this lady right here on the right, she's has pulmonary hypertension, and she has a Flolan cassette. And anybody that we send home on Flolan has to have a mixing partner, and that's somebody who comes to their house with them. They mix the medication together, they put it in the cassette together, and they hook it up together. If Flolan is ever discontinued, the patient has 7 minutes to get it restarted. So it's one of those things you wouldn't ever want to stop without being at a hospital or someplace where you could get access right away. Insulin pump is in the left one. The insulin pump is a small device, looks like a little cell phone, and it infuses insulin into the subcutaneous tissue, usually around the hip or the lower abdomen. So these are two things you'll see people walking around the community with these. IV medications, running out of insulin is a, and or the medication for pulmonary hypertension is an emergency. That person, you should call 911 and get them to the hospital. Most patients for Flolan and for insulin that's running continuously, they have a supply, and they keep a supply with them. Oftentimes, you'll see them carrying a little cooler around, and that's where the medication is. It does need refrigeration, both the insulin and the Flolan, and there's a couple of different ones that work like Flolan. And it requires special handling to prevent overdose, underdose, or infection. Because it infuses directly into the vasculature, it's very common, it's not very common, but it's very risky, and they could get an infection if it's not handled properly. Almost everybody who we send out at our facility with Flolan or an infusion pump of any type has family, friends, or an aide who assists them with their medication, mostly for safety reasons. So what are some other medication safety things that come to mind? You never want to share medication. So if you have a couple people in the facility and somebody's on Lasix and somebody else is on Lasix and they ran out of their Lasix, you still don't want to share it. Never crush medication unless you know it can be safely crushed. There is I think it might even be on the internet, you can Google it, a do not crush list of medications that should never be crushed. There are some medications that, believe it or not, can cause birth defects, that can cause cancer if you crush it and inhale it. You never want to take anybody else's medicine. Expiration dates, that's an important thing that people often forget about, but you wouldn't ever want to take a medicine that was expired. And that's mostly because the expiration dates guarantee, no guarantees in this, guarantee potency. Once they're past the expiration date, they may or may not be potent. And you would never want to alter the medication. That would be crush. Yes, sir?
Just clarification, the expiration date is when the drug loses 10% of its potency.
Okay, there we go. You would never want to crush or liquefy a medication unless you've been instructed to do so with the medication. Oxygen. Believe it or not, oxygen is considered a drug. We have to write prescriptions for oxygen, and it's got strict prescribing guidelines, and it's used in a variety of health situations. What are some situations you would use oxygen in? Anybody think of any? I'm going to make you talk.
Okay.
Pardon?
Surgery.
Okay. Surgery, yep. Bypass.
Welding.
Okay, so you can use it for to weld. How about for people? Yes, sir?
Trauma.
Trauma patients. Okay, very good. It can be used constantly, or it can be used on as needed. For example, some people with pulmonary hypertension, when they exercise, their oxygen tension drops down, so they put themselves on a little oxygen so they can exercise and not get that drop in oxygen saturation. You can deliver it with anything from a nasal cannula to a Veni mask, non-rebreather mask, and I've got some up here that I'll show you at the end. It can be used with CPAP. It can be used with BPAP, which is something we'll talk a little bit at home. And it can also be used with a mechanical ventilator. So it really runs the whole spectrum. Next slide. Oh, we talked about that already. A couple of different things about oxygen delivery. If you're ever taking care of somebody at a facility and they're getting more short of breath, you would never want to increase their oxygen without an order, basically, or without some direction. Sometimes increased oxygen can cause changes in pulmonary physiology and can actually worsen the patient's condition. So you wouldn't ever really want to do that unless that would be the type of situation you would want to call for a paramedic. They could have a concentrator. They could have a storage tank. Oxygen has become very portable, so people who require oxygen can get around more. They can get out of their home. They're not as homebound. These are some examples of delivery. We all know the nasal cannula. We see that on television. This is a simple face mask in the bottom right, and then that's a Venturi mask over on the far side. Next slide. So oxygen safety. You have to be really careful with oxygen, especially if you've got a big crowd of people in a gymnasium or in some sort of evacuation center. You want to just be careful, know where your oxygen tanks are, make sure they're being handled properly and monitored properly. You want to keep tanks at least 5 to 10 feet away from any kind of heat source or open flame. Securing the oxygen cylinder properly, either to a solid fixed object or having it in an oxygen tank storage device, is how you want to store it. You don't ever want to leave it standing up without it being secured to something.
Can you tell us why?
Because if it falls off and the valve is broken off, it becomes a missile, and it will shoot across the room. Obviously, no smoking. If somebody's in a car on oxygen, if they're in any vicinity, you don't want them smoking. You don't want to use petroleum-based products when people are using oxygen. You want to be careful with long lengths of tubing. I've done some home visits and seen, 40, 50, 60 feet of oxygen tubing. You have to be careful that people don't trip in oxygen tubing. If oxygen is pressurized in a tank, sometimes there'll be areas of ice. You don't want to touch those areas either because obviously it's very cold and kept under pressure. Oxygen concentrators, these have gotten very small in the last couple of years, actually the last 10 or 15 years. I know that you've seen the old big ones. The one here on the right is a small home-based oxygen concentrator. Some do have batteries, but my understanding is that the batteries don't last really well. They're pretty energy dependent. You can concentrate from 0 to 10 liters per minute of oxygen, and that's a big improvement. It used to be you could only concentrate up to 4 liters per minute. Oxygen concentrators work by basically they have a filter in them that absorbs the nitrogen out and concentrates the oxygen, and then it delivers it through the nasal cannula or mask. Any questions about oxygen? Yes.
You also don't want to have the oxygen tubing on because it can separate, because usually people plug them together.
Oh, right. Okay.
And also, if the oxygen level at the end, when the tubing is too long, a little diminished.
I don't know about that.
I have no idea.
Have you? I don't know. Yeah, and I would think if you're using a concentrator, for sure that makes sense. With an O2 tank where you regulate the flow, maybe not as much, but most people don't use O2 tanks at home anymore, mostly concentrators. So that's good advice there. So another machine that you're going to see people come with is nebulizer or inhaler. A nebulizer is a machine that helps deliver medications in an aerosol form into the airway, whereas an inhaler is a mist delivering the medication into the distal part of the airway. This is often used in respiratory illnesses such as asthma. People who have asthma use inhalers. Some of them use nebulizers. It's different ways to get the medication into the airway. We also use a lot of nebulized antibiotics for people who have some chronic respiratory infections. We also nebulize medications in people who have cystic fibrosis. We nebulize medications that help break down the mucus so they can expectorate it better. And you would definitely want the drugs and the method of delivery are really part of the prescription. So if they're using a albuterol inhaler or a albuterol nebulizer, it's all part of the prescription that they would bring with them. Some pictures of nebulizers. This is a simple face nebulizer. The machine on the right, I'm sorry, the left, my other right, is a home nebulizer system that allows you to nebulize medications such as albuterol is one medication or antibiotics, very common. This is a handheld nebulizer, often used with a spacer. Because you have to coordinate it with the breathing, oftentimes people will put a spacer on it, deliver the medicine into the spacer, and then inhale the medicine. So So mechanical ventilators. Have any of you ever seen a ventilator? Portable ventilator or a ventilator in the ICU? ICU, okay. Portable ventilator. Do you know somebody with ALS? Yeah. So portable ventilators, basically what ventilators do is they take over the work of breathing for the person who's on the ventilator. Ventilators, the first ventilators were developed for people with polio, and it was the iron lung, and it was that's a negative pressure ventilator, and they put the person in the iron lung. The gas is sucked out of the iron lung, the chest rises, and gas goes in the mouth. Now we do positive pressure ventilators where we put an endotracheal tube in the patient's airway and we blow the air in and out and ventilate them. It replaces the work of breathing for the person who can't breathe or can't breathe effectively for one reason or another. And it is a life-critical machine. There are everybody's different, and I've seen it, at 22 years in an intensive care unit, I've seen a lot of different situations. But there are some people who are only put themselves on the ventilators at night, and then they come off during the day when they are up and about using their accessory muscles to breathe, and then they go back on the ventilator at night. There's other people who live on a ventilator. Christopher Reeve was on a ventilator all the time. You will have people who are evacuated from home who are on a ventilator at home who will come to a evacuation center. They will bring their ventilator. They will bring their batteries. They will bring all their supplies. They usually have a duffel bag where they keep their tubing. They keep an Ambu bag. Everybody who's on a home ventilator has a tracheostomy. They'll bring extra tracheostomies and their suction material. Those are like the required things in the what they call the escape bag. And they take this bag with them everywhere they go. Most ventilators, the batteries can last up to 8 hours. The alarms start going off when they have 4 hours left. And that's just kind of a general rule of thumb.
What type of batteries are those for that in the
Flolan pump? It comes with what's called a CAD pump, C-A-D-D pump, and if that's the most, that's what most people use is the CAD pump. And the batteries, I believe, come from the durable, you know, the durable goods, whoever supplies the pump. The medicine comes from the pharmacy, but the batteries come from the DME company that supplied the pump.
You would have to get some medical supplies for it.
Yeah, because I think.
Yeah,
the insulin pumps take 9 volts. The CAD pumps, I think, are lithium. Are they 9 volts on a CAD pump?
Last time I saw it,
I'm sorry?
Last time I saw it,
they were 9 volts.
So we've
got shelters that weren't going to have. Yeah. When they have a spare, everybody has a CAD and a spare CAD, and then 2 spare medication doses. So when they use one medication dose, the pharmacy brings them another one.
8 hours is a lot less than I would have thought, because we have people that it might be 72 hours before we get to.
Okay. Yeah, that's hard. They're 24-hour pumps, so they get like 20 cc's of fluid in 24 hours, but they change the pumps every 3 days. So it depends upon what their prescription is. Some people, if they're on 60 milliliters in a 24-hour period, they have to change their pumps every 24 hours because they can't concentrate it. It's dosed in nanograms per kilogram per minute. So they have to, I mean, nanograms is really teeny, tiny. So, that's a good question. Batteries. So, and the batteries are getting better, especially for the ventilators. There's lithium batteries that are, they charge longer, and they keep a charge longer. That's, you know, assuming that you have a dry environment, a stable temperature, and not getting too cold. This is a picture of a bedside ventilator. It's about as tall as I am. It's a lot smaller than it used to be. These are the ones that we use at university hospitals. The ventilators, when we set the ventilators, we set them for a rate, a tidal volume. You can put oxygen into them, any percentage of oxygen up to 100%. Next slide. This is a picture of a lady with a portable ventilator on the back of her wheelchair. I think this is an LP10. Yes, LP10. Portable ventilator, goes right underneath, has a nice battery, can be maintained. People can get out of the house, get around in a wheelchair. Some people put if they can ambulate, they'll put the ventilator on their walker, provides them with some mobility. Next slide. So the patients who are on the ventilator will have a tracheostomy. They do require specialized training. And most people who are on ventilators don't go home on a ventilator unless they have family, friends, or an aide to help them 24 hours a day. They can't be left alone. They couldn't be left alone in a facility. They have to be able to hear the alarm when the ventilator becomes disconnected, because they can become disconnected very easily. You need people who are trained in the care and what to do in an emergency situation if the tracheostomy becomes plugged. People who take care of people on ventilators know how to suction the tracheostomy, clean the tracheostomy, and care for the tracheostomy. People can live for a long time with a tracheostomy at home on a ventilator. And the battery packs, I think we talked about the battery packs. The airway must be secured. You would want to make sure that the tracheostomy tube has little ties that go around the neck, that's tied to the neck. If the tubing comes off the tracheostomy tube, it's just a matter of putting it right back on and snugging it up a little bit. The machine does alarm. As soon as the machine senses that the gas isn't meeting any resistance, it will alarm, and you will know that the patient's off the ventilator. Has anybody ever had anybody on a ventilator in a shelter? No. When I was in Virginia and they would evacuate people for hurricanes and things like that, they brought them to the hospital. We made beds for them. We kept them in the hospital just because we could provide, you know, somebody 24 hours a day to take care of the patient, monitor the patient, make sure the ventilator was functioning properly. Bag valve mask. This is a bag valve mask. Basically what it is this mask comes off. This goes on a tracheostomy, and you deliver the ventilation with this bag. You can hook it up to oxygen. During Hurricane Katrina, there were people who were bagged for 3 days in hospitals because they had no power. So the nurses, respiratory therapists, doctors, everybody in a bag, 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 provide the ventilation that they needed until they could be evacuated. That's another thing that people who have a mechanical ventilator and are out and mobile with a mechanical ventilator will have in their bag at their side. Any other questions about? Guys, that's good questions. You're thinking. A backup power source is important. People that we send home from the intensive care unit on a ventilator, they have to have a whole house generator or a generator that can at least supply power to a room to provide power to the ventilator and the suction unit and the oxygen unit. That's all that's required. But we do send people home on ventilators. I have a guy right now who we're queuing up to send home with a ventilator because really that's what they want to do. Loops of tubing can be hazardous. If the tubing is pulled off the tracheostomy, that's okay. You can hook it back up. But if the tubing is yanked hard enough that it pulls the tracheostomy out, then the whole tracheostomy needs to be reinserted. And if it's a mature tract, it's not a problem. The people who are usually with these patients know how to handle that, but it can be very anxiety-provoking, as you can well imagine. Most people who and most homes that have folks on ventilators have special emergency evacuation plans. They pay attention to the weather. When the weather's going to be bad, they either move out early. And I know that a lot of this more from when we lived on the coast. Those people, they evacuated them first. They didn't stay behind for any reason. Having special emergency plans is part of our discharge plan on people who are going home with ventilators, just to make them aware that it's something you have to consider. They also need the same safety precautions for oxygen if they're traveling with oxygen and their ventilator as well. This is a picture of a tracheostomy. I couldn't find any that were really good frontal pictures. But basically, the tracheostomy is just a little tube that goes in just below the thyroid gland and just above the chest right here, right into the trachea. It does bypass the upper airway, so that filtering that the upper airway does, you lose when you have a tracheostomy. Any questions about ventilators? You guys are doing really good.
You may want to make a comment that people that have trach tubes in do not talk unless it's a bivalve trach.
Right. Or the trachs have balloons on them. And they can let down the balloon, take a breath in, and plug it, and they can speak. Or they can use a passimeter valve as well to speak. Most people who are on the ventilators at home who are ambulatory or at least can speak, they use either a cuffless trach, a bivalve trach, or a passimeter valve for at least part of the day. Okay, we went to the next slide. We're talking now about CPAP and BPAP. So CPAP is a common modality. We talked a little bit about it for obstructive sleep apnea. And it stands for continuous positive airway pressure. And basically what it does is it just stints the airway open when you fall asleep. BPAP, or also BiPAP, you may have heard it called BiPAP, is another modality that's bi-level positive airway pressure. And that provides an inspiratory pressure and an expiratory pressure to actually ventilate people. It's almost a non-invasive ventilator. We use these settings as adjunct for people who come in with respiratory therapy in the hospital. Who come in with respiratory failure. We treat people with CPAP first before we intubate them, if it's prudent, as a way to avoid the invasiveness of an endotracheal tube. But it is used in the community to support a variety of people with chronic respiratory failure in the community. So not just CPAP for obstructive sleep apnea, CPAP and BiPAP for things like heart failure, people with ALS, people with severe kyphoscoliosis or spinal deformities so that their chest is compressed. I have a young man right now who has spina bifida, and he has a very crooked spine, so he goes on BiPAP at night because when he falls asleep, he doesn't use his accessory muscles, and his carbon dioxide raises at night, and he wakes up sleepy in the morning and groggy. But when we use BiPAP on him at night, it just gives him enough support and lets his respiratory muscles rest that he wakes up with a normal carbon dioxide in the morning. So we're finding new modalities, new treatments for all different types of things, and then we're sending these people home. So they may show up in an evacuation shelter one day. Did I hear somebody ask something? The machines, both the CPAP and the BPAP machines have preset settings. You really can't even adjust them at home. They're set in the sleep lab or in the hospital, wherever the modality was first started. They're set, and then they go home with the patient. They can be attached to oxygen, or they don't need to be attached to oxygen. These are some pictures of somebody wearing some CPAP. Somebody wearing BiPAP would look exactly the same. It's just the different settings on the machine. So BiPAP's used for ventilatory support when sleeping. CPAP's used to stent open the airways, and they have different uses in the hospital. But if people are evacuated and they don't have their machine with them or they didn't have a chance to grab their machine, that may be something that they may need to get in order to prevent a worsening of respiratory failure.
They have to be set to the proper setting.
Mm-hmm.
Basically by prescription.
Mm-hmm. So CPAP and BPAP safety, again, you don't ever want to use someone else's machine for a variety of reasons, mostly because the settings are personalized for each person, you know, based on your sleep study or your medical needs. Again, long loops of tubing you want to avoid. They do have built-in humidity that you would have to fill the water almost every night. And the masks and tubing can be cleaned with soap and water, and most insurances pay for new tubing and new mask on a pretty frequent basis. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the key points that we did tonight? Well, I guess we did make it an hour. So oxygen safety, what are some important things with oxygen safety?
Secure the canister.
Yep, secure the canister. No smoking, away from heat. Good, good. People with medical needs will generally have the equipment with them, but I'm sure there are going to be situations like you were saying where they don't get to grab their bag. Providing safe haven, that's what you guys do, and you do very well. Enlisting the assistance of family and friends, people who know the patient or know the patient's situation and what their needs are. And that's it. If you have any questions for me, or if I can answer anything about this or about, I know a lot about the ICU.
We will open it up to Cuyahoga County, and I will try to repeat questions because I know you might be having trouble hearing some of those.
Now, this situation that just happened in Florida, where this apartment collapsed and a sinkhole, and people were told to get out right away. There's probably a lot of those people that if they had medical problems,
So we're talking about the sinkhole collapsing and the apartment buildings collapsing into sinkholes in Florida, and if you have to be evacuated quickly, you can't take any of your equipment with you. So,
I mean, that's a very good question. I think she brought that up before when people have to be evacuated quickly. Your answer is going to be you're going to either have to go to a facility to get the equipment they need or whatever you may have on hand at the shelter. It really depends upon the severity of their needs.
In this case, though, I can see, too, because it was an isolated incident, that a lot of people that need medical care could get into a hospital environment.
I would say
so.
So a limited emergency, probably you could use hospitals, especially in an urban area where you have a multitude of hospitals, but in a rural area or if you have lots of other things going on in that community, that might not be available.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or if the system's overwhelmed.
I guess intubating is the same as ventilating?
No, intubating is putting the tube in and then hooking them up to the ventilators. It's all part of the same process. But when people have a tracheostomy and they're on a ventilator, it's different, a little bit different. The endotracheal tube goes in through the mouth, down through the oropharynx and into the trachea. Sits right about here is where the end of the tube would be. And then we tie it in the person's mouth. If they're on a ventilator for more than 7 to 10 days, we put in a tracheostomy here, and take the tube out of their mouth and put them on the ventilator here. In the acute situation, the endotracheal tube is life-saving, works really well, but as you can imagine, it's very uncomfortable.
So a ventilator is used in either situation?
Yes.
She
was asking if the ventilator was used with the tracheostomy and with the endotracheal tube, and it is, yes. Yes, ma'am. So what I work a lot with the chronically critically ill, so I do a lot of ventilator weaning, and when we wake people up off sedation and let them breathe on their own, oftentimes if they've been sedated for a number of days, they're weak, they're frightened, they have tubes in their mouths. I spend a lot of time kind of in their face saying, you're okay, I'm not going to let anything happen to you. I hold their hand, I stroke their arm, I tell them just calm down, slow deep breaths, and a lot of it is just don't give them too much information, just tell them you're going to be okay. I hold their hand. I turn off the television because I think that's the worst thing. And I just try to do things to get them to focus on me, slow deep breaths. And oftentimes people's breathing will slow down because when we first let them breathe on their own, they'll start to breathe really fast before we've taken the tube out. But we have to make sure they can breathe okay before we take the tube out. So we let them breathe for 30 minutes, and that's wide awake. So they have this tube in, they're on a machine, in an ICU, coming out of sedation, and it's very frightening for a lot of people. So the nurses stay with them, I stay with them, whatever they need, we just stay with them. If they, in the ICU when they're breathing hard and fast, or if they're in a shelter, just be calm, get them in a quiet environment. Sometimes a fan helps because that makes them feel like they're getting more air. So you can either fan them or put like a light fan in their vicinity to make them feel better. But if they're having respiratory symptoms and can't catch their breath, they need to go to a hospital. But there's a lot that you can do as a person while you're waiting for EMS to come. And staying calm is probably the most important thing. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Do you still teach them some of the pursed-lip breathing to help calm their breathing now?
That doesn't work when you have an endotracheal tube in.
No, but I mean somebody that was anxious and...
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. people with emphysema trap air, so the more they breathe, the more they trap, the worse their symptoms get, so it becomes a vicious cycle. So if you can get them to breathe in and breathe out.
Breathe out through their lips.
In through their nose and purse lips out through their mouth. And that just helps slow their breathing. And then they're focused on that and they're not thinking about everything else, too. That's a very good suggestion. Yes, ma'am.
Concentrators are preferable to oxygen tanks?
They're more portable. Mm-hmm. And they don't require as much refilling. And you can, they're not as heavy.
Why would it?
If somebody's requiring a lot of oxygen, when my grandmother was at home on hospice, she was requiring 10 liters a minute, and they brought this tank that was this big in because she was requiring a lot of oxygen. That would really be the only reason. They use them, and paramedics use the tanks because they last longer because it's pressurized liquid oxygen. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. We plan to have another one in talking about children in disasters, and that will be November 6th. I will send out information as we get closer to that time. We hope we may actually have one scheduled in October, and again, I will make sure that you get any information about that. Thank you for joining us, and have a safe trip home.